The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
Welcome to The Beloved Community. My name is John Shuck. The Beloved Community is a once-per-month radio show. It was broadcast on KBOO in Portland for 3.5 years, 40 episodes, until last month, when KBOO staff, apparently, due to outside pressure, stopped the broadcast in the middle and played Christmas music. I've taken the show off of that radio station, and I've taken a sabbatical from my volunteer work there in protest. My show is available through the Pacifica Radio Network and on podcast. Go to progressivespirit.net. Why did this happen? That is the subject of this program. Dr. Kevin Barrett interviewed me about this event, as well as my exit from my church for his radio show, Truth Jihad. You can find it at truthjihad.com. Dr. Barrett graciously gave me permission and encouragement to rebroadcast the interview here. Here is the story of my journey toward truth and its obstacles, with appreciation for the courageous people who continue to remind me to carry on. This is Dr. Kevin Barrett.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, finding people telling you the most interesting truths that are being withheld from you by the usual suspects, powers that be. And there are more of those great people out there than anyone would imagine, than I would have imagined before I took this career path. And one of them is my guest today, John Shuck. John Shuck is a minister who has stepped outside of his church, apparently, due to maybe telling a little too much truth, a little bit too many of the hard truths. And it's quite a story. I mean, this to me is real Christianity. I may be Muslim, but I love real Christians, whether they're the Mennonites who built my house, the Amish farmers who live near where I live, the traditional Catholics I often feature on the show. And John Shuck is a wonderful Christian. Frankly, if all the Christians were real followers of Jesus, I don't know if the Prophet Muhammad's message would have even been necessary. I don't know. That's probably theologically incorrect speculation, to say the least. But it's great to see somebody actually walking in the footsteps of the prophets. And so, hey, welcome, John Shuck, and congratulations for telling too much truth.
Well, thank you, Dr. Barrett. I mean, that is very kind of you to say all of that. And in fact, as we go along, I've felt the same for you. In fact, my last radio show I dedicated to you and to Dr. Griffin, for those people who stepped out of their comfort zones to tell the truth.
That was very moving. Thank you. And it's quite an honor to be mentioned in the same breath with David Ray Griffin, another real Christian that I greatly admire. So let's tell the story for the listeners. Many of the listeners probably haven't heard that you've been censored on your radio show at KBOO Portland, largely for trying to feature me. And then you've also run into some problems at your church, apparently. So tell us about it.
Well, it is, interestingly, I think you feature into both places.
I'm getting people into trouble.
a good kind of trouble, and a trouble that I very much appreciate. Yes, I'm not really. I did radio professionally early on in my career for 5 years, and then I went into the ministry and have been a professional minister, a clergy person in the Presbyterian Church USA for 27 years. And I just finished my church job at the was November 24th was my last Sunday. I resigned there. Conflicts were getting to a point where it was I realized I just didn't want to do this anymore, and it had to do with the things that I was saying. It had to do with content, which was good for the church to kind of spell that out, at least those who opposed me. You know, it had to do with my speaking out against the war machine, my interaction with Islam a lot, which was kind of interesting, and then conspiracy theories, as they would say. So that had to do with not only preaching, but my social media and whatnot. And then the radio station, which I did as an extra part of my ministry, I guess, my public ministry. I started that when I was in a church in Tennessee, then carried that over here, and then got involved in KBOO. And I was very excited about being involved in KBOO as a progressive place, a liberal place. And that's where I come from. That's my kind of home, was this liberal progressivism. And then to find a connection there, and then to suddenly run into this brick wall that just confused me completely when I tried to have you on the show. And it was met with really a nasty smear campaign from the local Antifa group, calling you names, Holocaust denier and anti-Semitic, and had kind of a little, what was it, a video of kind of selections of things that you had said, which didn't seem really that bad, even out of context. But in fact, they weren't bad outside of, out of context, but it was framed in this, this system of, again, anti-Semitism was the big deal. And so I found that to be really, really difficult. And when I challenged this, it was really kind of unbelievable that this was happening. I thought, you know, smear campaigns, people will get that. It's a radio station after all. But they really did not. And were quite deferential to the critics, those who led the smear campaign. And so it ended up going for 20 months of I'm trying to appeal this decision and have you be able to defend yourself. And the only thing I got was resistance. I'd bring it up, and then I'd get a letter back from management. Here's what it is. And so it was never really any time of having an honest conversation about free speech or anything. And finally, as it turned out, when my church job ended, then I did my last sermon. I just kind of told my truth to my church of what was important to me. And that is that we need to end these wars, and we need to wake up about it. We need to wake up about the forces that are lying to us. We need to hold on to our truths. And a lot of that had to do with these false flags, such as 9/11 was a big one. And I couldn't, you know, it's like you get... What do they call that that phrase where they gaslighting, where they make you feel that you're crazy, right? When you're just saying what you see in front of you. And for me, it was easy. Building 7 comes down in 2.5 seconds, and that is just one of the
so 6.5 seconds. The people who don't understand the significance of that must be crazy, as far as I'm concerned. You know, they're not crazy, but there's some kind of mental block that's preventing them from seeing obvious reality, which is traditionally the definition of psychosis. So somebody's crazy here, but I don't think it's us.
That's it. That's exactly. But the propaganda is continually hammered against those of us who say, "Hey, this happened. This is an obvious thing." And so, in light of that, I just kind of told my congregation, this is where I am. These are people who I admire. David Ray Griffin, because he's a Christian theologian and really was, you know, really kind of gave the scholarship to the movement of 9/11 Truth when he started his books, New Pearl Harbor. And the one that got him in trouble with the Presbyterian Church, my denomination, was Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. That's how I first got introduced to him. And then your work and then my connection with you, meeting you in Portland in February 2018, and your work in just going on and just saying it, you know, saying what's going on and continually opening up conversations about things. So it's been an exciting time for me in these last couple of years. I'll just give a quick start. I kind of started this down this path of saying I needed to be more outspoken about 9/11 when I saw Massimo Mazzucco's movie September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor. And I did that on a continuing education week, a retreat. And I read that movie and I saw that movie and I realized there's a lot of things that need to be talked about here, especially the psychological aspect of those blocks that we have from being able to see what is in front of us. Why is it that we can't do that? Why are we so blocked from being able to understand hard truths? And so that was kind of my series of sermons that started me down a path of feeling I needed to be more open as a clergy person in a church and in preaching rather than just take the safe path. And it's led to some sacrifices, but I feel more alive than ever.
Well, you're walking in the path of the prophets. And, you know, one of the most recurring themes in the Quran, if not the most recurring theme, is God kind of consoling the prophet by saying this path of prophecy, of telling the hard truths that are inconvenient, especially for the malat or the notables, the wealthy and powerful people in society. It's a very hard path, and they're going to have rust on their hearts, and they're going to be deaf, dumb, and blind and not listen to you. And, you know, you're just here to give the warning and the promise and tell the truth, and you're not responsible for how they react to it. I mean, that's in practically every surah, majority of the surahs in the Quran, you're going to find that same theme recurring. And to me, that in a way is really one of the key things about Quran, is that really globally encompassing view of walking the path of truth of all of the prophets, you know, from Moses and Jesus, Muhammad, peace upon all of them, and presumably others from whether the Buddha or Lao Tzu or whoever, all prophets have told truths that are hard for the wealthy and powerful people and others who are hiding truth from themselves for what they think is their own benefit. It's hard for them to accept. And so I think a religious vocation always involves this. If it doesn't, then, you know, you're not doing it right. And so it sounds to me like you're doing it right.
Well, thank you for saying that. And sometimes it doesn't feel right. It feels very lonely. You end up losing a lot of your connections. One of the things that I lost this past year, I've been very involved with my denomination. I've always been kind of a thorn in its side a little bit in some ways, but nonetheless, very much connected part of my family. And the Facebook group, there's a Facebook group called Happy to Be a Presbyterian, right? And so I've been probably connected with that group for, since it started, I suppose. It's kind of the social media living room of our denomination. It has like 11,000 members to it. Well, I was banned from it.
What is it, like a little happy face living room where everybody has to put the little smiley button on?
Happy to be a Presbyterian. Isn't that funny?
You're making them unhappy.
I'm no longer happy to be a Presbyterian.
Yeah, right.
and the thing that got me in trouble was that all I did is I went on there, and it has political things. People can put whatever they want on. It's just an open group, and they argue back and forth, whatever. And I put on there the study that was done at the University of Alaska about Building 7 and its collapse, and I just linked to the study. And so it was removed like in 38 seconds or 38 minutes. And then I put it up again, and again it was removed, and a third time. And I went and talked to the moderators. I know them. So what happened? Well, you know, we didn't take it down. Maybe Facebook did. So I wrote
it.
NSA did. Yeah, who knows? So I did another post. Well, anyway, as it turns out, there was a fourth moderator I didn't even know about. He had come in and eliminated the thing. And eventually when I started to complain to him and he said, well, it wasn't scientific and whatever. It was just a lot of lame.
Wait a second. What were his credentials for weighing in on that study?
Right. He has none. he had that as well as he didn't think the conversation was going anywhere, so he deleted it and deleted the. But every time I posted a link to that study, it was removed. And when I finally complained to the other moderators about him, they said, "Well, you've been banned because you broke the rules." So I said, "Okay, I broke."
What
the
was
rules.
The rule? Complaining about bad moderation?
I guess so. I guess I just shouldn't have complained, shouldn't have whined about it. I don't know, but
moderators are there to stop people from getting into flame wars and, you know, insulting each other with intemperate language and things like that. But how could anybody defend taking down a reference to a university scientific study that has momentous political historical ramifications? Well, I guess that question answers itself.
I think that does. I think that's the key right there. It didn't matter what the answer was, but it showed me that these connections that I've had with my institutions are not worth it if they prevent you from telling what you think is true. If you can't tell the truth in front of a group of people, in front of a relationship that you have, in order to keep that relationship, you have to not tell the truth or hide it or deny it or whatever. I don't think that relationship is worth keeping.
And well, you did an interesting sermon recently. I just read a bunch of your sermons, and they are great sermons. If you had a church anywhere near me, I would be a church-going Muslim every Sunday morning to listen to that stuff. And one of them is about the institutions in the sense of the demonic possession of institutions. And you quoted a book I wasn't familiar with, a theology book that discusses the way that institutions often become guilty of idolatry, that is taking something, you know, other than God to worship is the classic definition of that. But these institutions, which are designed to do something positive, and religious institutions for worship of God and building God-worshiping community and so on, then they start trying to just promulgate themselves. And so the Catholic Church thinks it will do better if it launders money for the Gladio drug mafia through the Vatican Bank, because it doesn't like communism and the CIA drug mafia doesn't like communism. So let's work with the CIA. It's actually good for the institution, good for the Catholic Church, right? We'll get lots of money. And that's the way they think. And once you've done that, your institution is becoming demonically possessed in the sense of it's committing shirk or idolatry. That is, it's not about worshiping God anymore. It's about keeping the institution going, getting it, you know, more and more worldly wealth and power. So he had a really great sermon on that and on this idea of demonically possessed institutions. And you mentioned David Ray Griffin's work on the way the U.S. government is now demonic. I would add the Zionist entity as well. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how institutions becoming demonically possessed.
Yeah, I think the other book that I had mentioned there was Walter Wink. He wrote a series of books called The Powers Series, Naming the Powers, Unmasking the Powers, and Engaging the Powers. He did this back in the 90s. He was a biblical scholar than the Methodist tradition, and a very interesting guy. He did a lot in terms of when apartheid was happening, going down there and to South Africa and leading Bible studies with people. And I had a chance to do a retreat with him back in the mid-90s, and that's where I got introduced to his work. And it was really fascinating because he was a biblical scholar, definitely Enlightenment tradition, and yet he really had a spiritual, enthusiastic aspect to it. We yelled the Lord's Prayer, for example, at the top of our lungs, those kinds of things. Thy kingdom come, you know.
That sounds like some of the Tariqa Dhikr in Morocco, where people get really excited.
Yeah, that's him. So he really had an aspect to it, and he took all of that, all of the kind of the odd parts of the Bible, the things that most Enlightenment scholars don't talk about, the demonic aspects and the powers. That's what they talk about, the powers that are, it's not flesh and blood, but the powers behind all of that you can't see. That's where the real thing is. And so he talked about institutions, governments, churches. Everything has been created to do its job, to do good by God, but this demonic enters in, and it has to do with not like demons bunching around like Hollywood or something like that, but really it has to do with, like you say, when it becomes self-absorbed, those little things that we do to, as you mentioned, to survive for ourselves. We make deals with the devil, so to speak, all along the way, and that ends up really corrupting who we are. And so that sermon that you're talking about was based on the text of Jesus going into the land of the Gerasenes, and there's a man possessed by demons, and he's living in among the tombs, and he's chained up, and he breaks the chains. The people can't figure out what to do with him. And so Jesus goes in, and he casts the demon out, and the demon goes and lands into a bunch of pigs. Or he tells the demon, or the demon wants to be sent into the pigs. So Jesus sends them into the pigs, and they go down and drown in the lake. And then the people who live there see this happen, and then they tell Jesus, "Hey, we don't want you. Get out of here." And so why is it that people would rather have the demonic than that? Of course, the Legion is the name of the demon, which is it's an obvious symbol for Roman occupation of the Jews at that time. And the Jews don't eat pork. So who are these pigs for, right? Well, the pigs are probably for to service the occupying army. So here are people making a deal, right? That's their economy is driven on funding this occupation that oppresses themselves, but they'd rather have that than be free. And I think that is so true for so much of why we can't get beyond what we are. Well, what was it? Congress just passed $738 billion, you know, bipartisan, right? That's the one thing all of our Congress agrees on, is going ahead and keeping the war machine going. And we do that because every congressperson gets paid by it. In some form or another. Every congressperson in the backyard has some kind of thing that supports this military-industrial deal, as well as forces from the outside, as you had mentioned, Israel. So we tend to allow the demonic to take us over a little bit by bit by bit. I think the task, David Ray Griffin points this out, this is the job of the church, is to expose this demonic and to unmask it, in the words of Walter Wink, and engage it. And churches cannot do that. I don't know if there's any church that can take this preaching in the American empire.
Well, if the people in the church just did what you do, it would work. You know, your analysis of this gathering swine parable in the Injil or the Christian Bible, it echoes with a book I'm reading right now, which is Joan Mellon's book on Mac Wallace. It's called Faustian Bargains. Now, Mac Wallace was a guy who committed at least one murder for Lyndon Johnson. He was convicted of first-degree murder and given a suspended sentence. So he got off, walked out a free man, cheering and celebrating for time served, which had been he'd spent like 12 hours or 16 hours in jail when they first arrested him. And anyway, this Faustian bargains metaphor in the title refers to both the bargains that Mac Wallace, who was a decent left liberal idealist in college, made throughout his life to take him to where he ended up, which it looks like probably hell in the end. And then also Lyndon Johnson, who made his whole career out of these. He was the ultimate Faustian bargain guy. You know, maybe he was the devil himself. I don't know. But that Johnson, wow, he was amazing. Anyway, when he was told that, you know, this Vietnam War is not winnable, it's really dooming us. You can't have your great society and pay for Vietnam too. This is a terrible idea. You should just get out. He said, I can't get out of Vietnam. All my friends are making lots and lots of money on it.
Yeah.
So it's still the same old. It's the same reason today why nobody in Congress can really stand up against this war machine, as you said, or against the Zionist component of the war machine, which is responsible for a lot of the campaign contributions they're getting as well. And of course, religion, theoretically, is the place where the voice of the prophetic comes through and tells the truth about these matters and makes these people ashamed of themselves and hopefully changes their behavior, at least enough of it, so that the world gets better and closer to what God wants. But the religious institutions do seem to be just about as corrupted by these Faustian bargains as the political institutions, which is a really sad state of affairs.
Yeah, I kind of realized in these past years that I would have little luck changing an institution, but I think preaching or whatever it is we do on this aspect is about trying to hit an individual one at a time. And so when you talk about the prophets, you know, all the prophets in from the Hebrew scriptures are all failures in a sense. They didn't succeed. In fact, many of them died before. The only reason their thing is in the Bible is because, you know, they the future looked back on them. Oh, this guy told the truth. Well, in his own life, it didn't happen. So, and in fact, many of the things that they predicted of the doom and gloom really did happen. The point being is that the prophets spoke to other people who later would take that and come back with it later. It's about waking up people and you don't know how it's going to happen, but people may can wake up and then suddenly do changes later on. So you don't get the measured effects of being able to correct an institution, but individuals can hear it and then wake up another one and another one. And I think that's the hope to come.
It looked like that might work with the internet allowing people to start sending messages to far more people than they could in the pre-internet era. But now with all the censorship, there seems to be a pushback against this kind of red-pilling process where each individual awakens their local network, and then the nodes in this network are being targeted for censorship.
That's right. And that's the definitely the plotters come back. We kind of hope that the Quran will say they plotted and God plotted, but God's the best plotter.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your love for Imam Hussein. This is really unusual. I can see why your sermons probably alarmed many Presbyterians. You're the only Christian minister I know of whose sermons begin with quotes of the Quran, not just once, but I saw at least a couple of your sermons. Like one of them begins with Surat al-Inshirah, Alam Nashra Laka Sadrak Wadana Anka Wizrak. This is, you know, God has expanded thy breast one. And then what's the other one? You quoted another beautiful surah. Was it Shams, the sun? Anyway, you're quoting Quranic surahs in the opening of your sermons. And this has started happening due to your discovering there were some Shia Muslims near you, and you looked into their practice and made a pilgrimage. And I think we talked about that on the show once before, your pilgrimage to Karbala, Iraq. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the commonalities between Islam and Christianity and that you've experienced.
Yes. One of the things that is a disadvantage with Christians is that Christians don't know anything about the Quran. That's a big generalized statement. But generally, we don't. And the reason, historically, Muhammadism was considered a heresy. And yet, at the same time, Christians have incorporated the Hebrew scriptures. What has happened is that Islam has been left out. And so, because of that, I always feel it's been important to, even before I went on Hussein's trip, to include the Quran in Christian worship. To recognize that Christians don't have to give up being a Christian to accept that the Quran tells the truth, and Muhammad is a prophet for all of us. A few years ago, we did a kind of, with my congregation when I was in Tennessee, we read the Quran through in a year to try to become familiar, you know, with it. So there's a lot of Christian bad blood there. That is a lot of propaganda and a lot of misunderstanding over centuries, as well as in current times of in terms of prejudice against Muslims, that the Quran has not been seen as a book of which Christians can embrace. So that's part of the strategy of including the Quran into worship services, is to help people say, yes, the Quran is not this bad book. It's a book of revelation from God, and it's for us as well. So there's that part. But I also did have a real amazing experience in going to Karbala. And when I discovered this figure, Hussein, peace be upon him, it was like, wow. There's a mirror image of Jesus right there. And here are all of these people, you know, 20 million, 30 million of these people, very devoted and devoted at an emotional level. And then telling me that his ultimate thing was about sacrifice, about giving oneself for God, for what is good, for what is just, for what is right, including the ultimate. And I thought, well, that's just a similar story of why I understand Jesus to be. So suddenly I said in one sermon, I have two figures haunting me now, Jesus and Hussein, who are both really brothers in this quest. And so there's a lot going on here. First of all, I think of the Shia connection is there's a Shia Islamic center just across the street from my church. And so it all kind of fell into place. And so a logical thing would be, well, let's have a relationship. And I had known nothing about Shia Islam. I didn't know anything about Hussein before all of this started to happen, but I recognized that many of the people from the center were from places like Iran and from Lebanon and Iraq, and mostly all the places that the United States have been, you know, at war with. So I thought, well, gosh, they got something to say. I want to hear what's going on. And so that's kind of how it was, mostly just curiosity and wanting to find out what was really central to their faith and to mine, that we ought to be able to work together on this. And it's amazing how much resistance there is to that. Again, a lot of propaganda regarding in terms of Shia Islam and in terms of the walk itself and what that means. But I saw that walk really as a sign of a movement. First of all, a sign of the oppression of the world in terms of the Israel-Saudi-U.S. dominance and abuse and killing in the Middle East, the bad part of it, a sign of that, but also a sign of hope. Of real resistance, and it figured on this one figure, Hussein, who gave of himself for the cause of justice and for truth. And so that just really hit me intellectually powerfully. And then when I had a chance to go there, and even though this isn't necessarily part of my spirituality of visiting, you know, graves, at that experience itself of going and swimming through the bodies there and with my brothers there and touching and having be assisted to be able to touch the lattice work above the tomb itself, and a hand took mine and pushed it right up against it, and it was really emotionally powerful experience for me. And so that is taken and carried with me. So that experience, as well as the intellectual aspect of understanding who Hussein was and its connection to Jesus, as well as this is happening in Iraq, the country that we've bombed for what, really showed something's happening. And that kind of just, so I took it into my heart and also realized that this is happening for the world. And we need to be on the right side here. And Americans need to wake up and see what side are we on. And all of this media propaganda that we're hearing from, and it doesn't matter if it's MSNBC to Fox News, and your listeners know all of this, but this is relatively new to me and to my congregation of recognizing how much we've just been deceived continuously. And yet here is this powerful movement in the midst of Iraq that is really a sign of hope.
You know, I can see the kind of a Christian view of that, in that the West has really kind of crucified Iraq. As I recall, Gideon Polia has counted at least 10 million Iraqis murdered by the British and U.S. since, I believe, the 1950s. And, you know, Saddam Hussein, of course, got his start as a CIA hitman and took it from there. So how did your parishioners react to this? So the crucifixion and then the resurrection, I meant to say, of Iraq would be this kind of axis of resistance rising, symbolized in this pilgrimage to Karbala. So how did your the people in the church that told you that the content of your sermons was the problem, how do they react to this?
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned that aspect of the resurrection as a Christian. Yeah, that very much so. Well, I was honestly, naivete is apparently part of my blood, because I couldn't believe, honestly, that people would think that this would be anything but fantastic. So I go there, you know, and I come back and we make this little documentary about it. And for those who'd like to watch, it's For Love of Hussein on YouTube. And at first, I think people were very interested, and then suddenly something turned, and I don't know exactly what that was. It's still hard for me right now to put my finger on why it was. I think that could have been for a number of reasons. People might have been just kind of, whoa, he's become a Muslim. In fact, that's what people thought, that I just like switched religions or something. And I kept trying to say, no, it's just when you have an interfaith encounter. I mean, it's not really an interfaith encounter if you don't react at the level of the heart, that you don't take a risk that you might be transformed in this, that there's God speaking through somebody else. And then that's the point of it. It isn't that I'm switching one religion to another. I'm pretty bad at religion. I'm a Johnny Cash said he was a C minus Christian, and I would be that would be a good thing for me to be at that level. I would be worse.
If you could preach the way Johnny Cash could sing and play guitar, even if you're C plus, that's still pretty good.
That's right. So yeah. So the church, I think, was a little frightened. I think probably. And maybe it was a matter of strategy on my end that I could have gone slower or done it better this way or that way. I don't know. But I think they were a little put off by this, threatened a little bit by my connection and making this film.
I feel sorry for him. Our minister, he's turned into a Muslim.
Yeah, really. Well, that would be a good thing, I think. I mean,
well, if I'm sure they're taught the theology. I mean, it is in traditional Christian terms, it's theologically incorrect to accept the prophetic vocation of Muhammad, peace upon him. I don't think it necessarily should be, but traditionally the definition of Christian has been kind of the people that stopped at Jesus and said nobody after that, can be that relevant, right? Just like in Islam, we have the same issue with people who've come after the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him. No matter how holy they are, you can't call them a prophet. They're a saint, they're not a prophet, right? So there is this structure of the institution, and you are really challenging an important part of it there.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's all of our institutions end up taking the lowest common denominator, a part of it. And for me, it's about really finding out what is true and heartfelt. For example, I know we're going to have debates over whether what happened to Jesus, and I find all of those things rather tedious, because what I really see is that Jesus and Muhammad and Hussein and all these people are really powerfully connected, and connected with one another and connected with us, because they tell a truth about the powers outside that stop the good will of God from happening, or try to stop. And so that's the real essence to me of religion, all of its religions, regarding all of its trappings of what kind of robes you're supposed to wear and do this or that and all the rules and all of that stuff. But really, it's about finding that power to be able to resist the demonic. And that's a reality, the evil. I'm assuming the demonic has a reality in Islam too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's in Islam actually has a whole description of how it works with the cosmography or cosmology that is pretty much in line with Neoplatonism. That is, God is seen as this ultimate unity and point of creation of absolute intensity and absolute oneness. And then God's creation is God, dreams or through whatever you want to, however you want to talk about God's creative power, the world of multiplicity is brought into being. And at the highest level, closest to God, is the angelic realm, which is beings of metaphorically, presumably, pure light. And then a little further away from God is the realm of fire. And then even further away from God is the land of matter, of sort of dark and moist matter. That's the space-time material world that we inhabit. And so actually the demonic, in the sense of the beings of fire, the jinn, is closer to God than we are. But within that realm, there are intelligent beings that some of them are benign, and have chosen to go with, to say yes to creation and yes to God. And then there are those that have rebelled against God, led by the shaitan or Satan, al-Kabilah. It's pretty much the same story as in Christianity. So in this cosmology, the demonic is quite real, in the sense that I know in your sermon you were using it metaphorically, but in the traditional way of seeing it, and I think perhaps in actual reality, the demonic is real. There really are intelligent entities that inhabit this part of the universe that normally we don't encounter with our sensory apparatus. And within that realm, there are these bad spirits. And I know atheists or people who are totally non-religious who have accepted this based on their experience of things. Gordon Duff of Veterans Today, the editor over there, who saw briefings on alleged extraterrestrial entities while he was in the C-blank-A, believes that there is an investiture ceremony for the Rothschilds and other elite groups that involves calling forth a demon helper to the young elite member who is going to be, part of this billionaires club that rules the world. And so they have a guiding, tutelary, malign spirit. So, I actually think that's probably true. Only God knows these things, but it looks to me like there really is a that kind of demonic. So in that case, the prophetic vocation of all of the prophets, peace upon all of them, includes to resist the demonic, which is quite real. Of course, it's a tough vocation in a lot of ways. For me, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or the arrows sticking, getting shot into Hussein, are not so much the scoffing of the doubters and the people who are hurling abuse on those of us who try to tell the truth, but really the arrows that are the most numerous and painful are actually just having to put energy and consciousness into all of this bad stuff, all of this demonic stuff. If your vocation were not to resist the demonic, you could presumably be much more of a sort of positively oriented person, focusing on the joys of enlightenment. And, like many mystics have reached a state where they're in permanent ecstasy, which has a painful side, I suppose. But if you're focused on resisting the demonic, then, or even if you just have an internet radio show where you talk about really bad stuff all the time, it's that's the arrows of Hussein for me anyway, is just like every time I have to read another gosh darn Jeffrey Epstein story and think about that creep, it's another arrow. I don't know. What do you think about that? What do you think about to what extent is this, resisting the demonic part of what everybody is called to do? And if so, how do we avoid, there's a famous Nietzschean statement that, don't stare too long into the abyss or the abyss starts staring back into you. And, so what's the balancing point there between, all out resisting the bad stuff, seeking out worse and worse and worse stuff to resist and expose with the truth or whatever, however you're trying to resist it, versus trying to turn away from all of the darkness and evil in the world and stare into the bright sunlight of the good.
Ah, boy, that's great. You put it really well right there, that whole thing. Resisting the demonic is not all the fun it's cracked up to be. That's for sure.
Tell me about it.
I'll tell you a little bit. This is a little part of my story as well. First got in trouble a lot with my denomination and with everybody because I was the atheist minister. Okay, so in fact, if you go on the Friendly Atheist website, you'll find an article there that I posted. I'm a Presbyterian minister who doesn't believe in God. And part of that my work with the Jesus Seminar and basically Western Christianity that has basically kind of dissolved itself into secularism. There's a whole lot to say about that, but God and religion itself was really language. And so when you mentioned that, I talk about the demonic as metaphorical, it all comes from that. But I think there is a reality. In fact, that's been a change that's happened in me. So I used to think, that the universe was pretty much indifferent, that Galileo put God out of a home and Darwin put God out of a job, and there's nothing left except for, the universe existed as it did, and it comes down, it doesn't need any supernaturalism. Well, it's been actually my experience a little bit with Islam, as well as with some other thinkers like David Ray Griffin, God Not God, his book, G-O-D exists, but G-A-W-D does not. Did a review of that. Yeah. And so his work enabled me, because I realized part of it had to do with the emotional part, is that I need the kind of the universe to be on my side. It's not enough to be able to take on all of this stuff. And my first taking on had to do with peak oil and stuff. That was my, back in 2006, when I realized, gosh, we're right at the end. Where there's going to be a collapse coming, and I still think it is coming, and it'll be a dramatic one. That's kind of what started me on all of this, and what's the spirituality behind it. And all I really had was, atheism, so to speak. So being able to kind of discover God again through kind of process thinking, that God exists in every aspect, and creating the world out of chaos, and chaos has its own power and creativity to go back. But nonetheless, that for me has been important spiritually. To be able to recognize that if I have to do this on my own, or just a bunch of humans trying to take these on, all of these things that you just mentioned, it's really hopeless. There's someone on our side here that we call God. This enables us to not only just resist the bad stuff, but we have to also look at the good stuff of life too, and look at the possibility that exists, and look at these stories of people who throughout our religious traditions and throughout our history have done the good things, have been able to make life beautiful and true and lovely, and that's our focus too. That really is the primary focus. This evil part is a distortion, and it's very powerful, but it isn't ultimately all-powerful. And so I continually go back to that. But you're right, you can get really lost when you face the abyss constantly. We have to find ways in which to find the divine presence in all of this that gives us encouragement and compassion and a love for life as it is.
Hear, hear. Well, there is that great Quranic line that sort of truth appears and sort of the lies, shrivel into nothingness, and truth bashes out the brains of lies. But that process seems to take a while sometimes. So what are you up to next? You're out of a church, you're out of a broadcasting job, and I assume you're not going to be applying as the local spokesperson for Antifa anytime soon. Rose City Antifa is not on your list of prospective employers. What do you see coming for yourself? How are you going to continue your work?
Just one thing with Antifa, I like a lot of the things. I like justice.
Nothing wrong with being a social justice warrior if you're really doing it right.
Yeah, it's just this smearing of other people who are not getting that. But anyway, I don't know. I am in an in-between place, a liminal state for sure. I'm not sure what is next for me. I have some time because I have a severance package from my church, so that's good. And so I have some time to kind of figure it out. But I don't know if it'll be, I'm right now in front of me are my robe and my stoles and all my symbols of ministry. I don't know if I'll ever wear them again. I mean, that is kind of a strain. So I've got a lot of probably therapy to go through to figure out who I am right now. So I don't know what that will be. So I'm not really sure, honestly, where this is going to be or where it's going to go. But I imagine I will find out when I need to find out. I mean, I don't know how that'll happen. So I'm certainly open to whatever is going to fall into place. I mean, it's kind of wild. I'm 58 years old. I kind of hope that this was going to be my retirement job. Those security questions are real. But it doesn't look like that. Well, that isn't going to happen. So I don't know. It could still be something, I suppose, within the institution if anybody would have me now. But if not, then I'll do something else.
Well, listeners, if you want yet another reason to go all out for 9/11 truth, it's because if we win on this thing, people like John Schuck and Kevin Barrett probably will have a better chance of surviving into their deep retirement years.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah, it's, but you know, like I said before, I don't think I've ever felt quite so much alive as I have been. And then there's something to that. I mean, it is as, and I don't know if you experienced that yourself. Well, you were at, you know, I read your story, you know, the 9/11, the big lie that you wrote your book. And, when you were at University of, Wisconsin-Madison, and all of that kind of stuff. Did you feel that too? That sense of liberation, or was it pretty much all just bad news all the time?
Oh no, it was both. It was about 50-50, really. You know, the downside was, oh my God, after all of this jumping through academic hoops, a lot of it was, you know, which isn't the worst thing you have to do in the world, but still, you know, I had a really rigorous PhD program thanks to the recent, you know, the late lamented Harold Shoib, Allah Yarhamhu. He's my advisor, quite a rigorous guy. So I really worked hard to get that PhD and get going, and I'm just about to get going in my career, and suddenly this 9/11 thing comes along. So it was kind of frustrating in that respect, and especially for my wife, who had done as much of the sacrificing as I had. But there was also that liberating aspect of, you know, I got into this academic game really to be an honest public intellectual. And here I have a chance to really be an honest public intellectual. So let's go for it. You know, so there is definitely a liberation and excitement to that. So you're also learning tawakkul, reliance on Allah.
Yeah. Yes, my friend Imam Muhsin al-Dalami, who's at the Islamic Center, says, we call this a test. I said, okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, that's one of the cool, many cool themes in Quran, is that life is a test. That's, you know, that's really why God created us, was to see what we could do. And, you know, some of us are going to do better than others, but that's really what it's all about. And we, you know, we all have to do our best. To me, I find that, you know, the basic Islamic doctrines on things just make more common sense to me than most of the sort of classical Christian theological doctrines, much less Judaism. Buddhism, that's a different story. A lot of Buddhism makes sense too. But anyway, the basic idea that life is a test, and we're responsible for what we do, and we'll be judged for what we do. And if what we do weighs well in balance, the good things we do weighs well in balance with the bad things, then we will be in a better position when we step off into eternity. And that makes sense to me. The idea of being just a hopeless sinner whose sins are only redeemed by the death of somebody else, no matter how wonderful that person was and how, you know, momentous their death, that never really made sense to me. Like Patti Smith said, Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. So that, and I could go on like this all day and preach my, you know, why Islam makes sense sermon. But I don't know. It's I wonder how, it's just, we only have a few minutes left. Why is it that the many sensible and wonderful aspects of Islam are so massively hidden from the American people, while these bizarre extremist distortions of Islam are all anybody ever gets to see?
Oh, that's a good question. I want to go back to Jesus for just for a second, and sacrifice. And this is my thing. Christianity had it wrong. They had it wrong from the very beginning of thinking that Jesus died for your sins. He didn't die for anybody's sins. And that's where Hussein helps Christians. If for those Christians who do want to affirm that Jesus was martyred, and I do, and that it was a sacrifice, the sacrifice was like Hussein's sacrifice. He sacrificed himself. And for the goodness, and that is what David Ray Griffin talks about, communion. That's what we should think about when we remember Jesus as who was faithful to his resistance to the empire, even to his execution on a Roman cross. So I think that Christianity can learn from Islam in terms of understanding Jesus First of all, he never was any a divine being. A son of God was a title given to him, as Augustus was son of God. Well, the scandal is that Augustus isn't the special one. Here, Jesus is the one because he, resisted with love. Anyway, there's a lot to go on about that. But I think one of the things, why do Americans not get Islam? I think that partly it's because it's a religion that came after, and so we didn't regard it as important and didn't take the texts in. I think probably historically there's been, old battles in the past, but I think primarily, my opinion, is propaganda, because we want to, in the most recent times, take over Muslim countries' stuff. So that's part of it. And at the end of the day, I think the one of the things that's common in all these experiences that I've had with the Happy to Be a Presbyterian site, as well as the radio station, as well as the church, is free speech and how important it is. How important it is to have a pedestal somewhere in the public square that it just says truth on it, like the old BC comics, right? And you be somebody. It doesn't matter what it is. You be out, that space needs to be protected, and that should be the job of institutions of churches to say, no matter what, we will keep this space open. And that's what we're losing, isn't it, in our country, that aspect of a place where people can speak their truth. And I'm afraid that it's being lost. And you know that, too, I think.
We're striving to keep that space open here at Truth Jihad Radio. For people like you, John Shuck, I am absolutely, just in ecstatic amazement at the wonder of your work. When I started the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for Truth back in 2005, I looked fairly hard for professional religious people who to take this up. And, you're beyond anything that I ever could have expected back then. And I really admire your work to the end of the earth. Keep it up, brother. God bless. And I look forward to more conversation.
Thanks again to Dr. Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio, truthjihad.com, for permission to rebroadcast his interview with me. What will happen to the beloved community? One episode at a time. Find podcasts of all my shows at progressivespirit.net. Find me, John Shuck, on Facebook. Be well.